Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us again today on The Avid Reader, brought to you by my bookshop, Wellington Square Bookshop. Today, our guest is Mary Roach. Mary is the author of many New York Times bestsellers. I have interviewed her for two, or this will be the third, I think. Her books include Bonk, Packing for Mars, Gulp, Grunt, Stiff, Spook, and lots of other stuff, National Geographic and Wired, New York Times. She's won several awards, including the American Engineering Society's Engineering Journalism Award. However, she was the only entrant, which reminds me, on a tangent where I am wont to go, of my own championship in high school in the high jump. The other contestants had been notified that the meet was on a different day. So I won literally, single-footedly, introducing before he did the Fosbury flop. But okay, I tend to do this. Okay, her latest book is Fuzz, When Nature Breaks the Law, which will be published on September 14th, the same day as my appointment with my eye doctor. So Fuzz deals with nature's way of killing you, or at least maiming or poisoning you. We are introduced to bears, black and brown, elephants, leopards, monkeys, prominently macaques. Think Dexter and Night at the Museum, different species though. Danger trees, very nasty peas, that's P-E-A-S. You always have to do that with Mary. Birds and other sentient and semi-sentient beings out at various times to either attack or defend. You know, I've always thought of Mary's work kind of like a combination of David Sedaris and David Attenborough. And sometimes we read books and they teach us, instruct us. And sometimes we read books that make us laugh out loud. And it's really cool that Mary does both. You learn and you laugh. And for me, at least, the laughter pulls you along quite nicely through the learning, which is great for like high school students, seriously. So I could tell some more stories about myself, but it's time to introduce Mary. Mary, thanks so much for putting up with me for a third time.
Oh, geez. I never get tired of it.
So I always wonder who or what puts you up to these things. So I know you've talked about it a lot, but what was it this particular time?
Well, I was casting around for a story, a book idea, as I do. And it's never a tidy origin story. I wish it were for your sake. But I started off down the path of wildlife forensics, not where the wildlife are the perpetrators, but where they're the victims. I went up to this forensics lab in Oregon where they have this amazing hair library. You know, every species has five different kinds of hair. And this like amazing woman who could, you know, take a hair and identify, you know, this is not what you think it is. It's being sold as this, but it's that. It's, you know, she had become an expert in identifying counterfeit tiger penis, which is sold medicinally and, of course, illegally. So I thought I was going in that direction, but as it turns out, you can't tag along with anyone on an open case, an open investigation. And I need to tag along. You know, it's just what I do. It's just not interesting to me or as interesting for the reader if I can't have these scenes and get to know the people and have conversation. Anyway, so that was a dead end. And then I kind of eventually came around to, well, what if the wildlife weren't the victims, but the perps, you know? And that's a kind of a vexing question. You know, you have the animals that are breaking, you know, you name the law, there's animals that do that, but of course they don't know what the law is. They're just animals being animals, trying to get food, trying to get a warm place to have their babies. And, you know, you as the human have kind of provided this. So now there's a conflict. And then as it turns out, there's an entire science built around this called human wildlife conflict. And that was interesting to me because anytime there's a realm of science that I was unaware of, I get kind of excited, like, oh, I wonder what happens there. What are the labs like? What is the field work like? So that's how it all rolled out.
That's how it generally happens with you, I guess. It's a good thing that tiger penises aren't generally a dead end because then there wouldn't be any tigers. But
true.
So I like your research, you know, sometimes it's really pleasant, like when you're interviewing the lovely, beautiful Parisian scientist who's researching saliva, except for the gross saliva. But, and then sometimes you're trudging around in like all kinds of semi-nasty areas. You ever get scared, or do you just move ahead, not even thinking about, hey, I might be in danger? And seriously, in this book, you might be in danger.
Did I tell you the thing that I worried most about in this one? I was going to go out with a mountain lion researcher who was doing a statewide population count of cougars, mountain lions in California. And he said, if you're coming with me, you know, we're going to be crawling through a lot of poison oak. And I'm really allergic to poison oak. And this completely freaked. I wasn't worried about the mountain lions. I was really worried about getting a really bad case of poison oak. That was honestly what I fretted about. Not so much mountain lions. We were close. We knew from the tracks that there were some in the area. But, you know, I knew enough about the rarity of the attacks and also the fact that they're not interested in humans. We're not their prey. It's very, very rare that they would attack a human as dinner.
I remember once I was taking a ride with this guy who really had a pee, and he went off the side of the road, and he inadvertently ended up peeing against some poison oak. And it was very unpleasant for him.
Oh, that's horrible. Yeah. No, that's awful. I feel for that guy. I thought you were going to say, you know, because that is the one moment when I went off in the woods to pee in this area where there were mountain lions. And because I know that, you know, when you're peeing as a woman, not as a man, but as a woman, you're making yourself small. You're squatting down. So you look like an easier dinner. You know, you look like less of a threat. And there was a case where somebody who was, I think it was a man, not peeing, but crapping. I think, and this is in Canada. The details escape me, but he was attacked. So that was in my head. So I was a little nervous, a little bit.
Yeah, remember, obviously you remember, but in the bears, I forgot whether it was black bear or brown bear. I know the saying. What is it? Black bear fight, brown bear? No, yeah. What is it? I forgot.
If it's brown, lie down. If it's black, fight back. But that's not very good advice, as people can read about it in the book. But anyway,
and you talk about making yourself as big as possible.
Yeah, exactly.
It's funny, going back to research, and I guess we should start with bears. Oh, and then maybe laws against insects. But with regard to bears, it's funny, and these are your funniest areas, is like when you're like appointed secretary and when you mistakenly took centimeters for millimeters. Tell that.
Yeah. Well, I was at this, it's called the Wildlife Human Attack Response Predator Training. And this is a training for wildlife officers who they're the ones that get called if there's a mauling or a killing, and they sort of secure the crime scene and they collect evidence, et cetera. And there's, you know, they're doing stuff like looking for blood spatter patterns, and they're looking for hair, and they're examining the victim and doing all that. So we had a practical practice. They had set up these fake crime scenes with these soft touch mannequins that had been gored up, and doing all the things, collecting evidence. And there were there was a team of five of us. And the guy said, well, yeah, you'll be taking notes because you're the writer. So every time they go, well, you're really good at this. So you fill out because you had to fill out these four evidence forms. There's like five different kinds of paperwork. And they're like, well, you're a writer. So you'll be really good at that.
And then you made
Yeah. So in fact, I wasn't very good at that. I was noting the space between the inside, the canine teeth marks on the mannequin. And I wrote it down in centimeters, not millimeters, which would suggest that like a T-Rex had committed this crime, committed this killing. So as it turned out, yeah, I'm not the person you want taking notes.
And you know, that's when I laugh out loud, and just a few pages later talk about your comment with regard to the mannequin and the two dots on her back.
Well, we were examining the different kinds of injuries on these mannequins that had been, you know, they had been mocked up to look like attack victims, like people who had been killed by various types of animals. And they were talking about, okay, the difference between perimortem and postmortem, like you look for, is there bruising or bleeding, which would suggest this was the animal that attacked the person that made it rather than a scavenger. and they flipped the body over, the mannequin over at one point, and there were these two like little divots. And I said, that kind of looks like scavenging to me. And they're like, Mary, that's from the injection molding when they made the mannequin. Yeah.
Yeah, there was one woman who got all the answers right. And then you kind of like screwed it all.
That wasn't me. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is when I laugh out loud, and usually I'm reading in bed. And so this is when I shake my wife and wake her up, and she doesn't think it's nearly as funny as I've thought it. I feel sorry for her. Do you ever laugh out loud when you do it?
Yeah. You know what? I think that maybe once per book, I make myself laugh out loud. I'm trying to think what it might've been in this book. I'll get back to you.
I know what it was. I know what it was.
What?
It was when you described the guy that was the rat killer and he was dressed to the T's. And then you talk about his bag, and then you said, it either contained a rat or a something. And then you said,
a sandwich
or a rat. And you went, I don't know which one of those it was, but it was so nice the way you said it. It was like very polite.
That's funny that's what you zeroed in on.
It was just your observation. I don't know which that was.
I don't know. I didn't. It was this tidy little metal box. Plus he had this really natty outfit for somebody who was a rat searcher, like board ships and calculate the number of rats, often based on the amount of rat shit. And he had this little, like brass. He looked like almost like a bellhop's uniform in this little metal box. And I'm like, I don't know. Is there a rat in there or a sandwich? I don't know which.
What? I forgot what you said his hat looked like. That was the best part too.
Yeah, a pilot. I think it looked like an airline pilot would wear. Yeah.
So yeah, that was my toe. And then also when you said, I'm not pulling this out of my fecal bag.
Oh, thank you. Yes, I was quite proud of that one.
Yeah. You have to laugh. I mean, and because you and I are kind of similar in that fashion, I end up not talking about the science. So we should go to bear. Well, no, before we go to bears, talk a little bit about this absurd idea of the 19th, 18th century of attempting to censure and prohibit these nasty little creatures from continuing to bother and berate the human race.
Oh, well, in the going back even further, like 15, 16, 1700s, the legal system, weirdly enough, was one way that authorities tried to deal with the depredations of a lot of insects, sometimes rodents. And the case that I talked about in the book had to do with a town in northern Italy, where when caterpillars were eating the crops, at one point they decided, we will take legal action against the caterpillars. And they posted summons on trees near this land. And on the summons, it directed the caterpillars to appear in court on a specific day, at which point they would be assigned legal representation. Obviously, the caterpillars did not show up in court, but the city fathers decided, well, what we will do is assign a plot of alternate land for these caterpillars. Well, by this point, the caterpillars had pupated, become butterflies, were probably dead by then. So it was an interesting approach. And the way the author of this book described the reasons for it, it wasn't like they really expected caterpillars to march into the courtroom on the specific date and time, but it was a way to show the populace, we're in control here. We can take care of all matters, and even nature is subject to our control and our laws. And so it was kind of a way of just sort of a spectacle of power is the way that author of that book interpreted it. But it was quite a bizarre. I mean, and it was, you know, animals were put on trial and sometimes put to death. I mean, and sometimes they were livestock, and you would think in that case, it would be the owner of the animal that would be put on trial or punished, you know, for negligence and something like that. But there was a time when it was the animals themselves that were put on trial and sometimes put in prison and hung. I mean, it was a very strange way of dealing with problem wildlife.
I remember when I was practicing law, I had a case, Gibson versus 140 sheets of plate glass. I didn't represent the plate glass, and we won. I think he was a gratuitous Bailey or something like that. And yeah. So bears.
Wait, what did the plate glass do? Why was he?
The plate glass was apparently on another person's property. So it was trespassing. And he was the gratuitous Bailey. That is, he had the property, but he didn't ask to have the property. So somehow, I think William O. Douglas represented trees, a grove of trees.
And attempted
to provide them legal status.
Yeah, yeah. When I was in India, someone told me that the current Prime Minister Modi had granted personhood to the Ganges River, which was kind of astounding. By that, you know, personhood, it doesn't mean the river got to, you know, get married and vote and things like that. It was just more of, I think, a way of protecting the river, I guess. I don't know any more about it, but yeah.
Yeah, corporations are considered persons under the law. Oh, I'm doing this again. I'm trying to sell the book. Okay. So bears, let's go back to black or brown, black versus brown bears. And is Yogi Bear a black or a brown bear? And what about Boo Boo?
Boo Boo was blue, wasn't he? Isn't Boo Boo blue?
Well, you have a picture. Yeah, you have a picture of Yogi in the book.
I know, it's not a color picture. I'm going to say Yogi's a black bear. That's what I'm going to say. He's a very American bear, and we have more black bears.
So tell us the difference and how you go into that.
The difference. You mean in terms of what you do if you encounter one,
and also their personalities.
Well, I don't know that much about the different personalities of a grizzly as a brown bear. When people say a brown bear, it's often they're talking about grizzlies. So brown bears, the bigger, more northern species. Our national parks, we have a lot of black bears. So the when it's black, fight back. When it's brown, lie down. Is not very helpful because a lot of brown bears are more black in color, and a lot of black bears are brown. So that's not a good way to tell them apart. Also, it's not really by species is not the best way to determine what your course of action should be. It should be, is this a predatory attack, which is very, very rare, or is this a defensive? Did you startle this bear and it wants you to back off? In which case the bear is just bluffing. It's going to just run at you and try to look really scary, but it's not going to follow through and attack you. So in that case, you want to look big, back away slowly. Not necessarily even look big, but just sort of don't seem like a threat. So just let the bear know that you're just backing off, doing what it wants you to do. If you're in a situation where the bear is, where an animal like mountain lion or something seems to be bent on attacking you, in that case, do everything you can. If it's actually coming at you and jumping at you, then try to go for the face. Do whatever you can to fight it off if it's really bent on attacking, which is very, 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 very rare.
Yes, and your wildlife officer who was attacked was, I can't remember whether it was a mountain lion cougar, and bit through his shoe. And then he asked the guy.
It was a weird scenario because he got a call that this old couple in a house, this is up in Canada, rural Canada, that there was a cougar like stalking them they're in their house. And they were claiming that this cougar was stalking them, which is very, very odd for a cougar. So I think he kind of didn't take it that seriously. He got out of his truck he didn't have a weapon. And he's like knocking on the door and he looks over and like, there's the cougar. And they like ears flat, tail switching. And he's like, uh-oh, the cougar jumps, sinks its teeth into his shoe. And he's dealing with this and he's like yelling at the people, like the old guy in the house. He's like, I need a knife. I need a knife. Get me a knife. And the guy's like, what kind of knife? It's in the dishwasher. Hold on. He's like, any knife.
Think about trying to be rational. I mean, it's pretty hard to be rational when the adrenaline's in, you are in strict fight or flight mode, and you're like an antelope or a cow. I mean, a cougar is going to run a long time chasing you, and you're not going to run nearly as fast.
Right.
And I think that's the way most people respond, is just take off.
Yeah.
And that's,
yeah, this was a cougar because it, you know, cougars in California, like a decade will go by without a single fatality. They're just, we're not on the menu. We're not what they eat. But this cougar, in the case of the guy who knocked it on the door, they found out after, because he did prevail. He was able to kill the cougar before it killed him. And they found that the stomach of the cougar was blocked, like it was starving. So it was very weakened, and it was in a position where it was like, you know what, these two old people inside this box, I could probably do them. I could get them. So it was not a typical cougar scenario.
And then in all these situations, there are these two competing positions about if there's attack, should we kill the attacking animal or do we let it go? Because it wasn't, explain how that concept works. And it runs throughout your book, especially with elephants.
Sure. Yeah. Well, yeah. You know, I spent some time in India, where India is culturally their take on animals and what should be done about them is influenced by the fact that it's a Hindu country, and a lot of the gods are portrayed as animals, or their spouse is an animal, or they're riding an animal. So there's this lovely kind of connection with wild animals and nature for everybody that they're sort of immersed in. So there isn't the sense of quickly deciding, oh, just kill that thing. You know, there's a more measured process. But the problem with some of the animals, for example, monkeys, because there's Hanuman, the monkey god. So people both are vexed by these urban monkeys, which create a lot of mischief. But on the other hand, they give them food as an offering, kind of, you know, because the monkeys all hang out by the Hanuman temple, where people go in and make offerings, but then they come out and they give food to the monkeys that are hanging around outside, kind of like a live version of Hanuman. So they both want the problem to go away, but they are creating the problem by feeding these animals. But in general, they have a very it's very difficult for the authorities in Delhi to get anything done, because people are very resistant even to trapping and relocating the monkeys. Like, nobody wants that job, to be a monkey trapper. It's just, there's a lot of stigma attached to it. You just don't mess with a monkey because, you know, Hanuman, they're like, you revere and give offerings to them. And so it's an interesting conundrum.
In a much more simple vein, and I thought it's funny you're talking about Hindu, in a much more actually Zen approach, you have the one rancher who says, whenever there's livestock, there's dead stock.
Yeah.
I thought that was such a logical, intelligent way to respond to all of this.
Yes, she's that rare mix of a rancher and an animal activist. And she's talking about coyotes in particular, and which some, you know, they'll prey on. If you keep sheep or goats, you may have coyotes taking some of the animals. But she said, well, yeah, but you're going to lose some to disease. You know, you're going to lose some. If you have livestock, there's going to be some dead stock. She had a very, it's the cost of doing business approach to it, rather than, God damn varmints, you know, just a different approach, which I liked.
And then there's animals like goats that you wouldn't think of as, you know, being bothersome, but I didn't know that, and I didn't even understand it at first, why that was something that people would be. Talk a little bit about goats.
About goats? Oh, well, yeah. Goats? Did I write about goats?
Oh, no. I know what it was. Yeah. Was it goats that they put the strap on?
The harness?
Yeah, the harness.
Yeah. No, the goats, yeah, the reason they were, there was some researchers, they were trying to, these are wild goats. And they were trying to do a population count, trying to figure out, and one way you can try to figure out how many animals there are is by looking at how many little piles of turds. Like, you can do a pellet survey, sort of looking at the numbers. You know, it's basically poop as proxy for pooper. So in order to figure, they had to, but to do that, you need to know the animal's defecation rate, like how, so part of the research was to, you know, get that baseline. So somebody was trying to figure out, okay, well, we'll put a little harness on the goat to collect the poop. And so that's what you're referring to.
Right.
And there was a problem because it was a leather harness and some of the other goats would eat the harnesses off their buddies. So.
Yeah. I have a goat named Beatrice. She's very nice, but she tends, you know, I go up before I go out and talk to her and yeah, we have a good relationship. And, but she tends to eat my shirt sleeves without me knowing. And usually it's when I'm going out somewhere where it's, I don't know, yeah, black tie optional or something like that. And then I don't really worry about it. I don't change, but I am gnawed at the end.
Do you have Beatrice because she keeps the plants? She mows the lawn or?
She has her own. It's three goats, her children, Star and Stripe, because they had, when they were born, one had a stripe, one had a star. Uh-huh. So Beatrice, Star and Stripe, and then the alpaca, who's nameless, but has kind of joined them and I believe thinks she is a goat. Along with the peacocks and there, I'm talking about me again now. So
that's okay. I'm tired of talking about me. Let's talk.
Yeah. Yeah. It is difficult when you're asked the same questions every day.
But you're not asking the same questions. This guy, I just get tired of hearing yourself talk. So I was curious about Beatrice. Yeah.
She's lovely. She's a beautiful fawn colored and she's very pleasant and she really likes to communicate.
She's got those weird rectangular pupils, though.
Yeah, that's really weird.
Kind of creepy out, right?
Yeah, it's kind of alien.
Yeah, alien. Are they the only ones that have a square pupil, right?
Yeah, I think so. I've never seen one on any of my other creatures or any people.
I think they are an alien race. Watch out for Beatrice. You don't know what she's up to.
Oh, no, I'll go up there sometimes in the morning. And the goats and the alpaca and the chickens and the peacocks and the dog are all together and they're talking. And I know they're plotting against me.
Of course.
I know they're thinking of something that they can do to me. And it's very irritating and scary. But
yeah. They're having a conference. They're formulating a plan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When I got the peacocks, I didn't know they lived to be 40. So they're going to be at my funeral laughing at me.
God. They live till, I had no idea.
Yeah, neither did I. I wouldn't have gotten them. I hate them. They hate me. I hate them. They're indestructible.
They're loud too, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. If anyone sleeps over our house, that's it. One time. It's like someone's honking a Volkswagen horn for all night long.
Yeah, I used to work in a zoo. There was peacocks. Uh-huh, yeah. I worked at the San Francisco Zoo.
Oh.
So there were peacocks roaming around, but they weren't as loud as the Simangs were the loudest.
Really?
Simangs, they have this weird throat sac that they puff up and it, I don't know, projects their calls all over the zoo. It's quite impressive. So between them and the peacocks, it was quite a racket.
Yeah, I was at that zoo one time and I was with my daughter who's always embarrassed by the things that I do. And I started making hyena noises and the hyenas joined in and it was really, really loud. And this one of the employees came over and said, "What happened?" And I said, I have no idea. They just started doing this.
You disturb the hyenas. You know, the hyena gives birth through its clitoris.
What?
Seriously, no. In fact, it's true. Look it up. There's a hyena research facility up at Berkeley near here. And I mean, they didn't tell me that, but somebody knowledgeable.
I think you're making that up.
No, look it up.
I'm going to look it up.
Seriously.
Okay. Since we're done.
All right. I mean, it's not in any of my books. I haven't fact checked it, but I'm pretty sure it's true.
I figured it would be in your TED talk on orgasm because
it didn't make the cut. Didn't make the cut. But it is an interesting fact. So.
The other funniest thing in your book was when you're talking, we can talk back about it, but stotting and pronking. And you said pronk. You actually said pronk was I think it's your favorite word in the book. And of course it is because it's exactly like a title of your book.
Yes,
like
pronk.
That's a title that you would have, pronk.
Yes, anything with a one syllable and a K, yep, is prime Mary Roach book title territory. So pronk.
Oh, show your book. Show your book title. I mean, your cover.
I don't know if I'm connected here. Hang on, I have to move. My laptop is on the laundry basket. I'm pulling the laundry basket closer. There we go. Now pushing the laundry basket back. There it is.
There you go. Fuzz.
There you go. Fuzz.
Oh, yeah. There's
That's
not too
an
many
actual
books.
Patch that exists. We had these patches made for a pre-order promo that it's life size. It's a real patch.
So did you get one? Did you get a real patch? Did they give you any award when you were done with the outdoors courses?
They gave me a certificate. I have a certificate. Yeah.
You should frame it.
No, it's not. I should frame it. I know, but I didn't. Yeah.
Well,
I'm not that far gone.
There's not too many books that have two Z's. That's a good title.
I know. That's why I was pretty excited about the word fuzz. What other book? Can you name another book that has two Z's?
Buzz Lightyear, but that wouldn't be a title.
Yes, that's a movie, right? See, yeah, that's I'm the only one. I'm going to...
Books that have double consonants. That's how I'll start. Books that have double consonant titles.
No, it's going to be a double Z. There's no other... What other word is there? Buzz. Okay, maybe there's probably a B book called Buzz.
This is not selling your book either, you know. Well, maybe it is.
Yeah, you're right.
Well, it's funny, you know, because having a bookstore, everyone says to me, everyone says you can't judge a book by its cover, but every single person who comes into that bookstore judges every book by its cover.
I know. I know. It's like wine. I buy. If somebody will say, you know, this is a really, you know, at the wine store, I really recommend this wine. It's a great deal. It's amazing. It got great scores in Wine Spectator. And I'll be like, it's an ugly label. I'm not going to buy it.
Someone told me never buy a bottle of wine that has an animal on the label.
Oh, really?
Huh. Yeah.
Never? Oh, because it's bad wine?
Yeah. Like that kangaroo.
They're trying to sell it. Oh, yeah. That's Shiraz.
Yeah.
What is it with the yellow kangaroo? Yeah.
Well, I can't remember. Oh, let's move on.
Okay.
This has been like 10 minutes of wasted time for you. I've enjoyed it.
No, it's not wasted time. It's fine.
It is fun too. So talk about some of the non-animal. Let's talk about danger trees. That was the coolest part. I love that.
I like that part because I just like the combination of danger and tree was hilarious to me. It's like danger mitten, you know, or danger powder puff. You don't think of trees as dangerous, but there are people whose whole job is dealing with dangerous trees. There are danger tree assessors. I spent time up and there's a grove of legacy trees. These are like 500-year-old Douglas firs up in outside of Vancouver. And people pay money to see them because they're big and majestic and gorgeous. But when a very big old tree starts to die, it's a slow death. And at a certain point, it starts to rot from the inside, not necessarily easy to see. And when it starts rotting, now this big tree, it could fall. And if there's a windstorm, and it falls in the direction of the parking lot or the trail, because this is a lot of tourists come through here. So they have to balance the desire to have these beautiful trees for people to see and walk amongst with the danger that one's going to fall over and kill a few people. So that's why they have a danger tree assessor. And then if he determines a tree is too far gone and it's really a risk, then they'll bring in the danger tree faller blaster. And I'll let people read the book and learn about what that's like. But anyway, I spent some time with the danger tree people.
That was really fascinating.
The
interesting thing is like how people would come by or the Sierra Club kind of, and they would criticize these people who were actually doing good for nature. And they would just think they're felling beautiful old trees. And the cool thing was that you said you could still look up and it didn't look any different.
Right. They've just blast off the top. And then the other thing, because so they're so tall that you would have to have binoculars to really see that the top isn't there. And that makes it more lighter, more stable. It buys you some time before the tree is, you can keep the tree and still have it be safe. But the other thing that happens is that rainwater comes in the top and the tree kind of hollows out from the top, and then the animals can live in it. So it becomes, they call it a wildlife tree because it's real estate for a lot of different kinds of animals. So it's actually beneficial in that way. But anytime you have a combination of blowing something up and the fact that it's nature, you know, that seems off-putting to people. And it's just they don't understand the nuance of it, because why would they? They're just walking through the forest and they see some guy like blowing up the top of a tree and they're like, oh, you can't do that. But I think if they understood why it's being done and the fact that these trees are dying anyway, just, you know, Douglas firs, they die really slowly. It's like 100, you know, if your lifespan is 500 years, you like spend 100 years dying. So
they, I know.
Yeah, it happens pretty slowly. But anyway, they are trees that are on the way out anyway. But people, you know, they just see it and they think, that man is blowing up this beautiful tree.
I have a tree called a cucumber magnolia, and it's the biggest one, and it's a champion tree. But my ex-wife told me not to tell anybody about it because I don't really like people. And she said, if I tell people about it, they'll all come up looking at it. She says, you tell someone you have a champion tree, it's like telling them you have a big, you know, penis. It's like the same.
I wouldn't have made that connection, but.
Well, it's like now driving that, a like
so
driving
like when
a
you tell people that you have a big penis, they drive up and they want to see it. I could, yeah. They're like, hey, I came here. I heard you have a big penis. Can you show it to me?
And yeah, to make an appointment.
a cucumber magnolia. Is it called that because the fruit looks like a cucumber, or is the tree somehow, I don't know, do people pickle it? How is it cucumber?
No, it has a fruit in the springtime that is red, and it's very like that. Yeah, wow. And people are surprised by it. But then it got hit by lightning, and I've been trying to protect it ever since. So I called up Bartlett Tree Service and they came out and I said, you think it's going to die? And they go, yeah, but you are too.
Well, okay. Well, if you put it that way, so there you go.
I felt better about it. So you talk with going along with the tree thing, you talk about organizations that presumptively are in favor of taking care of animals and endangered species, but then actually are only doing it in order for them to go out and kill them and hunt them. And you mentioned a few organizations. Is Ducks Unlimited like that, or are they really good? I can't remember.
Oh, I guess you're talking about, well, there's certain, like here in California, we have out in the middle of the state, there's a lot of really beautiful wetlands where a lot of birds and snow geese and like 15 different amazing species of migrating birds will stop over on their way. Are they going north or south? Anyway, they stop over and there's a lot of them there, and people go out there and it is a gorgeous plot of land. The situation there, I mean, this is land that was set aside by the state wildlife agency in part for duck hunting. So there are little, you know, hunting clubs nestled in and among this land. But I have to say, you know, even though there is some irony there, that, you know, the numbers, if you've been out there, it's just the numbers of birds, there's a tremendous number of birds. So, you know, the hunters, there's a limit on how much they're taking. But the thing that stayed with me is when I was driving back from this quite beautiful stretch of land, is that this is what California used to look like. And now, you know, you pull away from these areas and then you're into the Central Valley, which is just all agriculture. It's just one monotonous flat plot of agricultural land. So it is kind of nice that these patches of California were set aside and are kept wild. It is ironic that the reason they originally were set aside was so that there would be always something to hunt for hunters. But we as birders, I'm a birder, benefit from it as well. I mean, it's probably not the best way to do it. There should be conservation of land for conservation's sake, but this is the model as it was born and as it still exists to a certain extent today. But it's an interesting scenario, yeah.
It's interesting when you talk about the birds. I think at one point you used the word murmuration, and those have always fascinated me because I can't understand how it's possible for them to know. You know what I mean? It's almost—
Yes. No, I know. The murmuration of, you know, these giant flocks. I think it must be sort of like, and I don't know, I'm just pulling this out of my fecal bag.
You say this stuff, you know.
I think it must be, you know, the blue angels, the way they do what they do, what I'm told is, and again, I don't know if this is true, but what I've heard is that you as the pilot, unless you're the middle person, you are looking at the, you're just lining yourself up with the person next to you. You're not looking ahead. You're just staying with the person next to you. So I assume there must be something like that with the birds where they're following the bird in front, or I don't know, because otherwise it would just be chaos. They'd just be bashing into each other. How do they not bash into each other? It's kind of amazing.
I read this tragic and heroic story. Maybe it's apocryphal, I don't know. But it was like five blue angels, and they follow the lead guy
into the lead, ground. Uh-huh.
Yeah, they just augured in because, yes. and they probably knew what was going to happen. They just did what they were supposed to do.
I don't know. They might not, if they're just following the, looking at the, you know, matching their wing that guy's wing, they might have had no idea until they hit the ground. And even then, probably no idea. So
it reminded me of, it reminds me of what's happening in America right now.
Yeah.
So yes, I didn't
driving
I,
into I was, the ground.
Yeah, we are pretty much coconuts. What I don't understand is, how were you able to get the exact number of people? All these statistics you use.
There's a research paper. Somebody, scientists went and they did the research and they published a paper that was peer reviewed and everything else. It's in the journal of, I don't know what the hell it is, but I found a paper. I looked it up on PubMed, I think it was, or Google Scholar that has all the journals. And I looked up coconuts and deaths, and there it was. Somebody did a paper, and that information is in my book. I always wondered about that, honestly, how many people are killed by falling coconuts. Because you sit on the beach, you're like, this is not a smart place to sit. There's a 2-pound object right over my head. That's going to fall. You know, it's going to pick up a lot of speed and dropping from that tree and hit my head.
I remember one time I picked up a ladder, not realizing that there was a hammer on the top of the ladder, and fell off and hit me in the head.
Ouch.
And that's as close as I've come. I was very upset with the guy who laid it there, but he was drunk at the time, which is why the wall he was building in his house was completely crooked. And then his wife came home and made him tear down the wall. So he, you know, he got what he deserved.
I was once killed by a falling rock saw. I was up in the Arctic reporting, packing for Mars, and they had a little Quonset shed where they had computers set up. And I was sitting at this computer, you know, and to the left of me and up was a shelf. And somebody, there was a bunch of vinyl banners that had been stacked up, and somebody put a rock saw, which is a, I don't know, 70-pound heavy thing, on this stack of slippery vinyl banners that had been folded up. And I'm working on the computer, and suddenly, whoop, this thing felt like missed me by inches. And the weird thing is that there was a webcam set up. So if anybody had been watching, they would have seen me, just my head bashed in by a, I mean, it didn't happen, but if it had, it would have been caught on the webcam. Isn't that weird?
It's interesting how you have those moments in your life where everything is so close.
It is. And I've had a few of those. Yeah.
Yeah, me too.
Maybe was the 9 lives thing. I think I'm on number 7.
Or else maybe you just split off and go into another random universe. You actually get hit, but you just split off. Your consciousness goes flying off. I always thought that could be possible. But the other thing that's really good about your book is that it's fun. You barely do it, but at the end of each chapter, you kind of have a slight segue into the next chapter.
I do.
You do that on. Yeah.
Oh, thank you for noticing that. Of course, I try to have some kind of, you know, flow from one chapter to the next, so it's not just completely. And I do want to kind of have the book kind of move in a certain path, so it's not just randomly thrown down on the page. Close, but not entirely.
the other one was the chapter on legumes and other plant stuff that because you talked about maybe in even that room you have plants that you had to think about because you realized they could kill you.
Oh yeah, right. There was a list of common garden plants that are a major toxicity. And I looked at the list and we had something like 9 of them in our yard at that moment. They're incredibly common. I mean, of course, you have to know how to extract the poison, and there's no reason why you'd just be eating large amounts of, say, hellebore or lantana, or even I think rhododendron was on the list. Because of, you know, a plant is it has to defend itself, and it doesn't have teeth and claws, it can't run away. So what does it do? It poisons, you know, it poisons people.
After all this research, and you have like kind of categories between animals, trees, plants, do you ever think about sentience, semi-sentience? Do you ever feel that there's actually some either self-awareness with either the trees or the plants?
Well, I notice with plants that if you repeatedly cut them back on a certain side, they'll stop. They'll go, okay, this is a waste of time. Let's just grow on that side. Forget about that side. It's not working for us. She's just going to cut us back. Obviously, they're not thinking that, but they're definitely adapting in that way. I mean, they're almost trainable, you know. And so I do think about that. Not that they're sentient in the same way that we are, but they are communicating and they are adapting. Yeah.
I always thought from the very first time I read anything you wrote, I always thought you would write a book called Roach.
I thought about it. Yeah, I did. I thought about it because there's a lot of interesting roach research. Roaches are.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it's a good idea. I thought it was maybe a little narrow, but I'd have to look into it. But I mean, as a topic, I don't know. How many people want to read 250 pages on roaches? I don't know. But you're right. It's a good idea.
I would, because they're like, you know, when nuclear holocaust strikes, they will survive. You know,
they will.
They evolved, and then they said, just like you said, this is fine. We don't need to change. Yeah. We're cool. And that's the way they've been for 300 million
years.
All
right, well, maybe I will one day. And I'll put you in the acknowledgments.
In a roach book. Yeah. But it's a good last name.
I'll dedicate it to you.
Even better.
All right.
Well, this is a question. So I have to veer back to a Terry Gross question, which is, what are you working on now? Which I never like to ask.
But. Oh, yeah. No, another book. It's not about roaches. It is actually not something I've even submitted, the proposal, that is. So I'm not really talking about it yet because I don't even know if it will be a book, but I am working on it.
Do you have the one word, one syllable title yet?
It's not one word and it's not one syllable. No.
What?
Two.
You can't do that. Well, yeah, you did. You did with Mars.
Oh, yeah. I can't do it. Just watch me. Just watch me. I'll do it again. I did it once and I'll do it again. This book was supposed to be Animal Vegetable Criminal. And we had to change it because of Mark Bittman's book, Animal Vegetable Junk, came out in February. And Norton said, well, it's too close. It'll seem like you stole his idea.
Anyway. Yeah, but you still can do whatever title you want. You could write a book called Gone with the Wind. But yeah, it wouldn't be smart. You could. You're allowed
Gone
to.
Gone with the Wind.
You can't copyright titles.
I know. Yeah. But, my, you know, I listen to my publisher. They've been good to me.
Yeah, they have been good to you. And yeah. Do you vet the covers, or do you get a choice or several?
Well, they're
choice?
Really good about sending me different iterations and getting my input. I mean, ultimately, I don't have right of refusal in my contract, but it's never been necessary. They've been very good with that. Yeah, they get good people.
That's great. Makes a big difference.
It does. Oh. It does.
So I think we get your book in, you know, in a box that says "Do not sell until." So I think it's coming. And then my manager thinks, I open them. I always open them and take them out. And she thinks it's illegal and she's always afraid I'm going to get arrested.
Oh, like the tag on the pillow?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Do not remove under penalty of law.
Exactly.
My brother and I did that and we thought we were going to go to jail for the rest of our lives.
I did too. Yeah.
See, there's two kinds of people in life. The people who rip off the tag and the people who don't.
I'm definitely a tag ripper-offer.
Likewise. Okay, we can end with that. That's a good ending. We've talked for about an hour. So yeah, it was so nice finally getting to see you and talk to you this way.
I know.
All right, goodbye.
Okay, this was fun.
Yeah, it was fun. So I'll see you next time.
You'll see you next time. Again. Okay.
Okay.
Thanks.
All right, see you. Bye.
Bye.